Okay, great. Hi, everyone. My name is Buddy Shaw, and I'm GiveWell's Managing Director. I'm really excited to welcome all of you to our end of year event for donors, supporters, and followers of GiveWell. I know that many of you have attended these events in the past, while others might be new to GiveWell. And so, as always, we're going to try to cover a lot of substance in the next hour, but hope to make it as engaging as possible, whether you're new to GiveWell or have spent hours plowing through our cost effectiveness models. Before we get started, I wanted to encourage all of you to ask any questions you might have just by using the chat feature. In order to ask a question, just click on the button for chat at the bottom of your screen. The sidebar is going to open up and you can type your question at the bottom, and then someone on our team is going to be triaging those questions, which we'll get to later in the Q&A session. But before we get there, I'm really excited to introduce our speakers. Ellie Hassenfeld co-founded GiveWell in 2007 and is GiveWell CEO. And Matt Iglesias co-founded the news website Vox, the famous Weeds podcast, and more recently has created Slow Boring, which is a phenomenal blog and newsletter focused on a wide range of topics, including American politics, public policy, and occasionally GiveWell and effective altruism. And we're just, you know, so excited to have Matt on board, not just because he and Slow Boring have very generously committed to donating 10% of their proceeds to GiveWell's Maximum Impact Fund, but more because he's just got a huge fan following within the GiveWell team, and I imagine all the more so amongst GiveWell supporters. You know, when we think about Matt, he really is the gold standard in the breed of writers and journalists who can actually cover complex, important topics in a way that's not just clear and compelling to a wide audience, but also doesn't lose the nuance and complexities. And so we're super excited to have him turn his explanatory and critical lens to exploring our work at GiveWell over the next hour. And with that, Matt, I'll hand it over to you.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much. That was a really kind, generous introduction. And of course, thanks to everybody for tuning in here and I believe hopefully for giving money to an important cause. That's really good. So Ellie, I mean, what I really wanted to ask you was just like, I've been following GiveWell, you know, a little bit since around when you started, and I feel like things have sort of changed a lot as you've grown into your awkward teen years. And I wonder what you think about that. I mean, how is stuff different now from where it was 15 years ago?
And the biggest change is, we're just directing a lot more funds thanks to everyone who's giving than we were back then. In 2008, which was our first full year in existence, we moved 35 grand. And I remember being surprised that we had been so successful. And this year we expect to move more than $400 million. And that's all supported by, you know, our research, which is much, much better. You know, you can go and read the research we did back in 2007, 2008. It's a little embarrassing, so please don't. But if you want to, it's there. And I mean, just to give one example of how research has improved, you know, a big question in international aid is when you're giving to a program like Malaria Nets, what does that cause other donors to do? And, you know, we think that when we direct money to Malaria Nets, we cause some of the biggest donors, high-income country governments, to give a little bit less. And our estimates of impact take that into account. And that's a big improvement in our research, where it's more sophisticated, capturing more of the total effect that donors giving is having in the world.
But that's not just the research changing, right? That's also part of the organization itself. Right. I mean, as you become a larger, better known, better established institution, what your recommendations signify sort of changes a little bit versus when you're fairly obscure.
Of course. I mean, GiveWell and its, you know, our community of donors is now one of the, you know, largest donors of malaria in the world. The Global Fund to Fight HTB and Malaria gets funding from rich country governments. The U.S. government, President's Malaria Initiative, and the U.K. government are big funders. And then GiveWell and his community is directing more than $100 million a year to malaria programs. And that means that you know, folks are paying attention, and we need to be cognizant of the role we're playing in the field as a whole.
And so you're also, I mean, you're just moving much more money than you used to. And that must pose some different questions, right? I mean, if you're talking about 30 grand, it's, well, okay, can we like find something really good to give this money to? But now, I mean, you must spend a lot more time thinking about like absorption of the volume of money that you have out there. And what kind of tension does that create?
Yeah, I mean, so way back when, the question was always, we have very limited resources. How are we going to give? I mean, that started way back when Holden and I started GiveWell. We started it each trying to give away about $5,000. And so where could we give that to do the most good? And, you know, we've been fortunate and excited by the support of the GiveWell community to reach a point where, you know, we're trying to find ways to give away $500 million or maybe more, maybe $1 billion or more in the next few years. And the challenge now is finding organizations that can utilize and deliver great programming on the ground at that scale. And that's really hard because it's you know, we want to give away money in ways where we'll be confidence effective, we'll know after the fact whether or not it worked. And it's especially important to know if the funding we directed isn't effective so we can change course. And you know, that happens all too infrequently in the nonprofit sector. And so doing all of that at the scale that we're at now is hard. It's, you know, literally the challenge we face today is looking forward to the growth we anticipate and finding organizations that can deliver that scale of funding effectively.
And so, I mean, does that mean that there's now a kind of a, like a, are you thinking about a bar where it's okay, if you cross this, you can be recommended, which is sort of different from, originally, I think it was more like a scalar question, right? Like there are a bunch of groups that are plausibly doing good, but what can we say we are most confident is the most cost-effective thing? But you now seem to be looking at an amount of money that's almost too big to just ask that sort of one question of what's most cost-effective and maybe looking at a bigger portfolio?
Yeah, so I think we're trying to think practically about what the threshold should be for where we direct funding to. You know, very roughly speaking, we think about our recommendations as averting a death for about $5,000. And so for the last couple of years, we've been focused on programs that we believe can deliver that impact per dollar. You know, going forward, our best guess is that that floor will rise, meaning it will go $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. That's a great thing. You know, what's happening is that the ability to spend a relatively small money and change or save someone's life is not available. It's not as cheap as it used to be. That's a great thing. And so we expect that to rise. And but we're still keeping that, I don't know, the optimizer's mindset, because you know, we don't want to drop the floor to $20,000 to avert a death when there's plenty of opportunity to do that at $7,000, $8,000, $9,000. I mean, I think that at the moment we see a lot of resources that we have to direct optimally, but you know, with the team we have, I think that we're going to find those opportunities, and we want to make sure that we're still using what in effect in the scale of all of the need in the world is still very small relative to what is ultimately needed globally.
And obviously, still small relative to how much people are giving in what is supposed to be, you know, useful charitable endeavors around the world. I mean, you're much bigger than you used to be, but it's still a huge sector. And so are there specific areas that you are looking into that, you know, I mean, maybe as long as we're just talking here instead of publishing official recommendations, you know, seem promising, or, you know, are you're giving them a closer look and are hoping to see good things?
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton. Let me give one example and happy to sort of dive through more as there's interest. So, you know, vaccinations, something we've been talking a lot about over the past year with COVID. Globally, in low-income countries, child immunization has stayed, you know, roughly stable at 70% of children receiving the vaccines they require in childhood since, you know, roughly over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So that means, you know, roughly one in 3 to 1 in 4 children is not receiving all the vaccines that they need. For a long time.
So these are like the old fashioned, like measles, Tdap kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this figure is the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, like the third dose, which is often used as a measure of children receiving their full schedule of vaccines. But yeah, all the old traditional stuff that, you know, we all got when we were growing up, and it's straightforward. So still, you know, 1 in 3 to 1 in 4 children in low-income countries don't receive that vaccine. They don't receive all the vaccines they need. And, you know, we know vaccines are effective and inexpensive. Delivery ultimately is straightforward. It's something that, you know, we globally know how to do. So the question is, you know, how can we use money to increase immunization coverage globally? And for many years, we struggled to find giving opportunities that we believed, you know, we'd give money and it would cause immunization to rise. But over the last few years, we've found one organization and then supported the creation of another that provides conditional cash transfers for immunization, essentially paying caregivers money, or in some context, giving a mobile phone top up for bringing their children in for immunization, very cheap, and then provides income to people who are low income while also incentivizing them to get vaccinated. And the research, including a randomized trial that we funded, show a massive effect on immunization uptake. And so this program is one that we've only directed 30-40 million dollars to over the last couple of years, but globally could potentially need $500 to $1 billion a year of funding to reach all the people that it could affect, and then might be the driver of increasing this immunization coverage higher in the future.
So, I mean, one thing that's interesting there speaks to the larger theme of change, which is that you guys are now not just sort of like doing research, but funding studies, right? I mean, and that's a sort of a bigger role, right? Rather than just gathering and analyzing, because it means you can propose questions that need to be investigated.
Yeah. I mean, when Givel started, we started with the mindset of, let's make sure we've looked at what is already out there. If there's research that's been done and organizations that are running, we just want to find the ones that can deliver and give them funds. And as we grew, we saw opportunities to create programs, support research, even support the creation of new organizations that could deliver the type of impact we're looking for. And so that's gone from, at the beginning, we didn't do that at all. Not that we didn't know enough. And I think it would have been wrong to come in and try to create something new. But now 15 years in, a lot of what we do is supporting the development of new programs, whether, sometimes that's like we did with this organization, New Incentives, which works on cash transfers for immunization, helping an organization get started from scratch and fund the research. In other cases, just working closely with an organization to support the development of the type of monitoring and evaluation. So an interesting program we funded a few years ago was supporting the delivery of amoxicillin for pneumonia in Tanzania. And a big challenge with pneumonia is accurate diagnosis of pneumonia, because the standard protocol is to count the breaths per minute that a child has, which, there's a lot of variation in how well that can diagnose pneumonia. And the organization we funded came up with a really interesting way to use ultrasound in low resource environments to get much more accurate diagnosis of pneumonia and then deliver amoxicillin to the children who needed it. And that was a function of something that we helped create with the questions we were asking.
And, I mean, this is an area I've gotten, interested in journalistically as COVID has become this sort of bigger and bigger story. But I feel like, a lot of the sort of big regulatory public health agencies in the Western countries are they're fairly conservative and somewhat rigid in what they can do. And part of what you're talking about there is sort of developing, I think, like more flexible diagnostic methods in the charitable sector. And is that like an area where philanthropy can fill in and do things that governments can't necessarily?
Well, I mean, I think there's three ways that we operate in this area, and they're all kind of taking different angles. So one is you can fund research into better practices that can be taken up by the government agencies when they make approvals. And in low-income countries, often countries are following World Health Organization guidance on what they should be doing. Another approach is to advocate to engage with the WHO directly and say, we have this research, we've seen this research, you should be updating in a different direction. And then finally, I mean, maybe the thing, I feel like the thing you often are writing about with respect to COVID is trying to move more quickly. And I think that we see this globally, that often there's evidence that a program works. And globally, we will get there eventually, but there needs to be a push to accelerate. And that acceleration is important because the cost of delay is years where people are not receiving a life-saving intervention. When we first came across seasonal malaria chemo prevention in 2014, 2015, it was years after the trials were completed. and it was still being implemented at fairly small scale across across Africa. And you know, I believe we played a large role in we GiveWell in our research, and then you know, donors in their giving, getting this program scaled up much more rapidly than it otherwise would have. And now it's part of the standard high-income country government, global fund, malaria set of interventions that are funded and is now at large scale. And so really just was a, you know, too bad that it took as long as it did and trying to play a role in accelerating that deployment.
And I mean, ideally, right? I mean, if you can make people think that there will be responsiveness to new evidence, that can help encourage people to like actually do evaluations or set things up that way. I mean, because the world is just full of sort of like perverse incentives to not, you know, actually check whether what you're doing works, right? And it's important to reward people who are doing that.
And in some long-term sense, I mean, I think that I hope that aside from the direct good that GiveWell can do by getting funding to programs that are needed, helping to create the mechanism through which there's an incentive to demonstrate your program works and find programs that are delivering a lot of impact per dollar. And then knowing that if you do those two things, you know, you'll be able to set up and run an organization that's effective. The organization I mentioned earlier, New Incentives, they started with that exact expectation in mind. They knew if they could deliver the type of results that we were looking for, then they'd be able to operate at fairly large scale in Nigeria where they work. And you know, I'm excited about that incentive that we can provide.
So a lot of what I think of as like GiveWell winners involves sort of like, let's use tools that exist, right? Like we can give money to people. We know that, or we have these nets, you know, for malaria and they seem to work well. Or, you know, we have these vaccines, but not everybody takes them. Can we design an intervention to get them? A lot of human progress though comes from new stuff, right? Like we invent those vaccines in the first place. And how do you see your role in kind of, you know, interfacing with that, like a world of innovation and the development, not just of program models, but of like actual things that can be brought to bear on problems?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the question we're always asking about any potential giving opportunity is, why are we the right funder for this? And what I mean by that is, you know, why is someone else not already stepping in and funding it? And so when it comes to a new model to deliver a program with high quality monitoring, let's say, we know that, you know, we're one of the groups that cares most about that. And if that's the type of program we're trying to develop, we're the right one to step in. When it comes to, let's say, like hardcore science R&D, that's something that might be in GiveWell's future, but it's not in our present because there's so many people that are focused on that. We wouldn't be in a good position to judge the quality of an idea. And I think we'd be more likely to make a misjudgment by trying to get into an area we don't know than to try and jump in there.
So somebody was telling me the other day, they were saying, you know, that like they like GiveWell and they give money to your stuff, but they also want to do some things locally in their community. And they wish that there was more like rigorous assessment of, you know, I want to do something. I want to do it in the Chicago area. I would like to be reasonably cost effective, acknowledging that like probably the lowest hanging fruit in the universe is not in Chicago, but like still you could ask the question, like which programs work and which don't. Do you think that sort of makes sense, or should we really say like, no, like the problems are in sub-Saharan Africa, like don't focus on your local community?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think it makes a lot of sense. I think that, you know, everyone, I mean, look, we all spend a lot of money on things, I assume, right, that are not maximizing utility globally. You know, we're all human. And, you know, because of that, I think there's a big part of donor psychology here where it's helpful to, or I should say this differently, it's not helpful to feel guilty or bad about helping people locally. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm here in the Bay Area and, you know, we see a ton of horrible poverty just walking around the street, you know, daily. So, I think it's important to recognize that. One of the hopes that I have, it's not GiveWell's top priority right now, but one of the hopes that I have is that we can serve as a model to other people that want to try to provide some of that information to donors who are looking at different causes. I think we had some success at this. There's a website, Animal Charity Evaluators, that focuses on farm animal welfare. And I think they very explicitly tried to draw on GiveWell's broad approach to how they do research. And I think that's one way we might be able to help create some of that information in the world for people who are coming at it with a different focus of whom they're trying to help.
Right. I mean, just it's like a model, right, of how you can structure thinking about these kinds of problems separately from the philosophical underpinnings. I don't know. There's like a metaphysical aspect to some of this stuff. I want to ask you about malaria specifically, because I know that's an area that you guys do a lot of work in. I think sometime during this last year of public health chaos, it was announced that there's a vaccine for malaria coming out. And do you anticipate that sort of changing the malaria funding landscape?
Yeah, so the vaccine that came out, we hope it will get deployed widely. It's less effective. It's not a panacea. So it's not effective enough to replace other existing malaria control efforts, but along with seasonal malaria chemo prevention, malaria nets, other indoor residual spraying and other malaria control efforts, it seems like it'd be a really effective tool. It's one of the areas where, or it's an example of something that is likely not being rolled out as quickly as it could be. And, we pay a lot of attention to the slow march of vaccine progress in the US and less attention when tools are being rolled out less slowly or more slowly in low-income countries.
Mm-hmm. But it's not sufficiently effective that it would make other things redundant or useless.
Exactly. Yeah. It's roughly, it's roughly like averts about 50% of cases. That's, kind of ballpark similar to NETs and seasonal malaria chemo prevention. It's hard to know exactly how costly it will be to deliver because it's been delivered in what are effectively very large scale randomized trials. And so we don't know what it will look like when it's actually rolled out. But our guess is, it'll kind of be in the ballpark of NETs and seasonal malaria chemo prevention, but as a great additional intervention, right, rather than a replacement.
Yeah. So, because that's going to be a complementary exactly, sort of dynamic between the two of them. Yeah. All right. Well, that's good to hear, I guess. So do you see other kinds of like noteworthy examples of these sort of like implementation lags? I mean, as long as I'm a journalist, should I go yell at people about something in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the lags, I think the lags that I mentioned a while ago, so SMC and then maybe the malaria vaccine now are two examples of lags where they should be moving more quickly. Another type of lag that comes up is, the hard work of going from the evidence as it was found in randomized trials to what needs to happen to deliver the program in real life, and navigating the difference between real life and all the pros and cons that are associated with real life and RCTs. So I'll just use seasonal malaria chemo prevention one more time. That was focused in areas with limited resistance to that antibiotic. And the question is, well, what about areas with moderate levels of resistance? It seems as if the benefit of delivering that this program might outweigh the additional cost of some marginal malaria resistance. And so now some trials are happening to assess the possibility of that delivery. That happened in a fairly slow way. Finally, like I think another thing that can cause delay, I mentioned conditional cash transfers for immunization. Another organization we're supporting called IRD in Pakistan, they have a randomized trial that shows they gave the same monetary incentive to everyone to bring their children in for vaccination. Now, as they roll it out in real life, they're adjusting the incentive to give a larger incentive to people who they believe are less likely to bring their children from immunization, a smaller incentive for people who they think already would be more likely. And just navigating the challenge of moving from evidence to implementation slows people down because it's hard to figure out how to make that work.
Yeah, and I think, you know, academics types are often interested in being like really original. So, you know, doing like small variations on existing studies seems to often be like not that interesting to them. But if you're trying to really design optimal programs, like that makes a lot of sense, right? If I hear, well, giving people $100 for X worked pretty well, like I'm really curious, like what if it was 110? What if it was 90, right? Like how do we sort of change these parameters? Because, you know, when you start talking about large scale effects, like knowing exactly what the right number is can be a really big deal.
And I think even more so, there's relatively little interest in, or one is not going to make their name as an academic, monitoring large scale programs as delivered in low income countries. You know, we recommended a program a few years ago that was giving people a small cash incentive to migrate from rural Bangladesh to urban Bangladesh during the lean season when there was limited work and food in rural areas. And that was based on several trials that showed a big effect on migration and income. And then when we did that, we also said, let's fund additional evidence because we want to see how this works at scale. And it didn't induce migration. And, you know, we've ceased funding that program because it didn't seem that it was effective. And, you know, that's the sort of question that's very interesting to us, but doesn't carry the same interest as coming up with new economic theories in the academy.
Right. Yeah. And how, I mean, how does it, is it tough to pull the plug on things like that? I mean, intellectually, like it's unimpeachable, right? I mean, you've got to check things up. And if it doesn't work out, you know, you got to let it go. But also, I mean, you're a person, you've got a team of people, you're working with other groups of well-meaning people. I mean, how do you make a tough call like that?
Yeah, so I mean, at a human level, it's hard. But I think that, you know, GiveWell at our core, you know, we see the responsibility is really to the people whom we're trying to help. And I mean, all the organizations that we work with feel the same way. And so I think ultimately, you know, we can have arguments about the evidence and about the numbers, but really like no one is gonna make the argument when a program is not working that we should continue it because, you know, obviously that's not in anyone's best interest. I think it's good that, you know, GiveWell has developed the reputation we have and the attention that we have because at this point, you know, even where I sit, the, you know, all of the incentives sit with, you know, make the hard decision to stop supporting the program that's less effective and be transparent about it because of the reputation we've built up that's what we do. So we act that way and we have to act that way. And I think ultimately that's for everyone's good.
Makes sense. So I think we're about 30 minutes into this. Should we see if we can bring in some questions?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks, Matt, for all those really interesting, fascinating questions. And I think a lot of the questions from the audience are going to build off of those. So, you know, the first question that's come up is one that we haven't had a chance to touch on here, but you know, it revolves around our decision this year to roll over about 20% of what we anticipate having access to next year. Because of the belief that we have things in our pipeline that are kind of more cost effective than we could spend this year. And so, Ellie, I think this one's for you. You know, the core question is, can you comment on GiveWell's decision to withhold a portion of their 2021 funding due to anticipated higher impact charities being found in the near future? And in general, the benefits of giving to programs now versus possibly holding those funds and donating in the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the reason we're holding, GiveWell historically has only looked at the question of where should I give if I want to give this year? Obviously, that's not the only question one could ask. One can also spread their giving over time. And if you think you'll have better opportunities in the near future than you have this year, it makes sense to hold back for that date. You know, generally, our bias is towards giving sooner because the needs are great and, you know, we want to help people now. But when we looked at the specifics of our position this year, and in particular, a combination of the funding we had, the opportunities to give, and then the pipeline that we see, the things that we think are going to, you know, we'll be able to give to in 2022 or 2023 that we can't give to this year. So those are things like conditional cash transfer for immunization, malnutrition, you know, additional programs in public health regulation. You know, we see major benefit to, you know, holding on to the funds for the near future. You know, our team has grown really quickly, our research team. And so even in the past year alone, we've increased the amount of funding we're able to direct from about $250 million to $500 million. And so we are confident that we're on track to, you know, find much bigger gaps that we're going to direct this money out to in the near future.
But so is that primarily because the research isn't quite done yet, or because you think the organizations themselves are not quite ready yet, like in terms of understanding the motivation for the delay?
Yeah. So, I mean, we could go to an organization and say, you know, here's $250 million to deliver a program over many years, and they would certainly take it. I think there's basically two reasons we don't want to do that today. I mean, first, giving them that much now won't make a difference to what they do in the next year. It takes time for them to hire staff and scale up to have the infrastructure to deliver a program in an area they haven't worked in before. And so we could move the money from our books, so to speak, to their books, but it wouldn't accelerate you know, program implementation. And then the second issue is that we're learning as we go. And so I mentioned the example of No Lean Season before, where, you know, we gave some money early and then within a couple of years, we had learned that the program was less effective and we chose not to continue giving. With some of these new programs, that's bound to happen. And so there's also, there's a cost of overgiving before we have the opportunity to learn as much as we can, because we won't be able to get that money back. You know, all that said, I'd say that at this point, we're erring pretty far on the aggressive side with trying to move money out the door quickly and encouraging, you know, especially the excellent organizations we work with to scale quickly. But, you know, trying to be judicious about not asking them to go more quickly than they can do so effectively. Makes
sense. Thanks, Ellie. And building on this question, kind of tying back to one of Matt's earlier points, that there's, you know, almost a metaphysical or philosophical part of this, you know, on giving now versus later. One of the questions from John Palowich is, you know, do you consider it a good thing that the floor to avert a death has risen from, say, $2,000 to $5,000 to $7,000 or $8,000? And how does that affect your view of how we're making progress as a world?
Oh, it's a great thing. You know, that we did a little bit of an exercise last year where we tried to estimate what the cost effectiveness of GiveWell programs would have been in 1980 or in the year 2000. And, you know, back then the, you know, child deaths were so much higher. And, you know, at a time when vitamin A supplementation wasn't rolled out globally, when malaria nets were not an intervention that had an effectiveness, I think one could have averted a death for a few hundred dollars. And that's clearly worse, because it just means that the world is in such a state that one can give a tiny amount of money and avert a death. And so the further that we get towards, you know, more money, fewer child deaths, it costs more to avert terrible things, the better off we are.
I mean, you're saying essentially that the lowest hanging fruit has been sort of picked, right? And people are being helped in those ways. Not that the baseline cost of helping per se has risen.
The lowest hanging fruit is gone. And that's what, and I'd say our job is we're always trying to find the lowest hanging fruit that exists and fill that. And over time, what we should expect is that as it goes away, we're moving further up the tree.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. The next question from Dan F. is just around, as we grow, you know, what are our plans to develop formal or informal relationships with other large funders? You know, Ellie, as you said, the founding vision of GiveWell was two guys trying to figure out how to give $5,000 away most effectively. And now we're in a different world where we're directing hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And so how does that change our plans around engaging with other large funders in the space?
Yeah, I mean, so it's been another big shift from, you know, who we were in 2007 when I think we literally tried to get the Gates Foundation on the phone because we wanted to, we saw that they had made all these grants and we said, well, what criteria did you use? We want to learn from you. And you might be surprised to learn that they weren't that interested in talking to Ellie and Holden in 2007. And now, you know, we have relationships across the spectrum of actors in international aid, whether it's funders, people in governments, academics, you know, public health agencies, you know, not only because, you know, they can give us information that helps us find giving opportunities, but because they're a great source of feedback for us on what we might be getting wrong. And, you know, there's a lot that you know, we can learn, but, you know, at the end of the day, GiveWell's an organization of generalists rather than experts. And so we really need those relationships to learn the specific things about each program where we really don't have the subject matter expertise.
Thanks, Ellie. Matt, I want to turn around one of the questions that you asked Ellie and which has been coming up in some of the comments from attendees around just this balance between whether you should support local causes versus, you know, quote unquote, where you can save the most lives if you valued all human lives equally. And I remember one of the articles you had written, I think it was in defense of good writing on controversial topics, you kind of talk about Slate Star Codex's view of everything just seems like peanuts compared to being able to save children who otherwise would have died due to malaria when you can do that with a few thousand dollars. And you said it's a view that you feel sympathetic to, but also disagree with. And so I'm curious how you process that same question that you asked Ellie around, you know, what are our obligations to give locally versus globally, and just how you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the question with all these things is about, you know, what kind of margin are we operating on, right? And if I look at the philanthropic sector as a whole, I definitely think that there is there's way too little rigor and there's too little cosmopolitanism, right? I mean, it continues to be fairly dominated by, you know, rich people giving money to schools that they attended, you know, or just like things that their friends are interested in, and pushing people toward more cosmopolitanism, I think is good. At the same time, also, the United States of America is a very wealthy country, right? Very few of us, myself included, are giving like all that we could be giving, you know, in life, right? And whatever can sort of invest people in other people's lives and motivate them, you know, I think is good, right? I think it's constructive to cultivate, you know, a moral sensibility of caring about people other than yourself. And, you know, I think for most people, that does involve some concern for communities that they participate in and that they have some kind of emotional connection to. And I just think it's like, it's probably wrong to think of money that's given to malaria charities as strictly crowding out money that is given to art museums. You know, like that's not, I think like the relevant margin on which these things kind of operate, and not necessarily like the real conflict that exists in the world, especially when you're talking about, you know, I don't know, like people like me, frankly, right? It's really easy to say in today's America, well, you know, I'm not a billionaire. Like I'm not the guy who has all this money, but it's like, don't I actually have a lot of money compared to like the average person in the world today, compared to the average person in human history? Like, shouldn't I challenge myself to do more for somebody? And if you could tell like any kind of plausible story about like why you're trying to help somebody, I was a philosophy major in college. So, you know, I could argue all day about like, what is the ultimate like true value system? But almost everyone is just like being more selfish than even according to their own like view of the world they really ought to be. And I just really feel that, you know, encouraging people to like give more to something, to think hard about something, makes some kind of sense.
Yeah, that's well said, Matt. Thanks. So the next one is a question for probably both of you from Pedro Barbuda, who's asking, you know, what would you say to whether a donor should donate to one of the, trying to find what is like the best giving opportunity on GiveWell's list versus just donating to GiveWell's Maximum Impact Fund? And Matt, maybe I'll start with you because this is something we were talking about before the session started, just around the extent to which you're able to like either dig through the full cost effectiveness models yourselves versus trust that someone's done the work well and kind of like give at their discretion. And how do you make that judgment? And then Ellie, you know, I think from your perspective, how would you advise an individual donor trying to figure out whether they should choose what they think is the best one amongst GiveWell's giving opportunities versus just giving to the Maximum Impact Fund?
You know, I mean, I'll say for me, like I have looked at the cost benefit spreadsheets. I think it's interesting. I have, you know, recommended GiveWell to other people in my life and as a journalist. And I do want to say that I've done some kind of due diligence on it. At the same time, like I can't work my way through all of them. That would be very time consuming. It's why there's a big staff of people that does it. And I don't always fully, you know, understand everything. You know, there's a lot of footnotes that go off to other things. And, you know, so I try to do a little bit of a, I would say a sampling, right? It's like, well, if I kick the tires on this, does it seem to make sense? And it does. And that makes me feel comfortable with the whole thing. But I feel like it's a, you know, it's a pretty large operation of people who are spending more time on this than I am. And so I personally came around to like, I want to defer to Maximum Impact. That's what I want to encourage other people to do because, you know, we're living in a society here and there's a kind of hubris and thinking you're going to ultimately do it on your own. Also with all of these things, I mean, it would be interesting to know, okay, which of these top charities is like actually the best. But they're all quite good, right? I mean, there's a good margin of life-saving to be done here. And on some level, to me, like fussing about it does not seem like a great use of time or emotion, especially because one thing you do see when you do dig into the footnotes is that there are some, there's some just tough questions and hazy assumptions at little bits of the models for each one. So when you scrutinize it at a certain level of detail, you know, you're coming down to like two different people's guesstimate of a given variable rather than anything you're going to find incredibly hard data on.
And I mean, practically speaking, I agree with Matt. I mean, I think it's hard to really dig in and figure things out on your own as a part-time job. You know, and GiveWell's really set up to try to make it easy for folks to get recommendations they can trust because of the process that focuses on transparency and puts information out there. So you can rely on it knowing that, you know, it's been looked at by a large number of people and is based on pretty objective criteria, if not always even if the decisions themselves are not always fully objective because they can't be in charity. I do think there's a benefit though to digging in for folks who are so inclined, which is, you know, notwithstanding the success that, you know, GiveWell's had, and maybe even more broadly, what's happened in the community of people who are trying to give effectively and think critically about charity and philanthropy, still a sort of a niche exercise. And I think there's real benefit in getting more familiar with what it actually looks like to try to make these decisions and to try and, I mean, if possible, contribute to them. And so for those who are so inclined, you know, I think digging in and understanding what goes into these decisions, you know, might help you. Who knows? It might help us, you know, might lead you somewhere that enables more of this type of activity to happen at GiveWell or elsewhere.
I was going to say, I mean, it is also just, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it's there are worse things you could do to sort of cultivate your intellectual skills than look at this stuff because it's, you know, they're interesting questions. It's hard work, but they're also really important questions as opposed to, you know, some of the things we spend our time on.
Yeah. So, I mean, both Matt and Ellie, building on just the idea of this being pretty interesting set of questions to consider, Eric McKenzie is just asking, you know, how do you describe GiveWell's current thinking regarding whether you should save a life versus doing a quote unquote, comparable amount of good in other ways? And, you know, just more generally, how do we think about the moral trade-offs between life-saving programs versus things that improve income or other aspects of life?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really hard question. Some would say an impossible question to answer correctly, but I can tell you the approach that GiveWell takes, which is, you know, we ultimately, you know, find ourselves in a position where we're trying to judge whether to give to a program that averts the death of someone versus a program that increases income for, let's say, 200 people by some amount. And we literally have to decide, you know, which program should we direct the marginal dollars to? And the way that we've decided to arrive at to answer that question is to try and create the equivalent of an exchange rate between those two goods. And just to be clear, we don't think that we have the right answer, or in some sense, like the truth is GiveWell's on the question of how to answer this question of moral philosophy. But it's the approach we take to try and judge between the two opportunities, because they sit in front of us. $1 million to give directly to give cash directly to very poor people, or $1 million to a malaria program that will avert the deaths of young children. And then setting those weights themselves, that exchange rate is itself a very challenging exercise. We've done a few things. We've looked at academic literature that tries to ask people, questions of how much they would pay for, various things that could happen to them, and gets to get at the value of a statistical life. So this is one input that can be used. Another is we directed funding to an organization called ID Insight. It's a group that Buddy founded and was formerly the CEO of, to do research in low-income countries and directly ask people who would be the recipients of the programs we're supporting, how they would value income versus health provision. And then finally, we've surveyed our donors as the people who are ultimately giving the money, how they would make these choices. But I think this is one of the cases where the more that you might think that you have a different moral philosophy than GiveWell, or might choose a different outcome than we would, there can be a real benefit to digging in enough so you can decide, how you'd rather give your funds rather than just trusting GiveWell. And I think it's worth knowing that this is an example of the sort of, challenging philosophical judgment that has to go into the research we do. I mean, charity, it's not a math problem. So it's not like we're going to do all the work and then finally get prove that we have the right answer. Instead, there's a bunch of some pretty difficult judgment calls that we're trying to make and then trying to be transparent about, so folks can decide how they want to engage with the research and decide what to do.
Thanks, Ellie. So obviously a general theme running throughout this conversation and in GiveWell's work and in the broader GiveWell community is just this question of how do you do as much good as possible, not just through your charitable contributions, but also with your time. And so Matt, Robert Rand is asking, and this is a bit of a personal question, so I hope you don't mind, but how do you feel like you're doing more good, whether through the direct impact of your writing or through things like donating 10% of Slow Boring's proceeds to places like GiveWell?
I mean, the stuff that I write on, I think, unfortunately, does not save lives in the same direct way as really good charities do. I mean, I do, advocate on the margin for official development assistance and things like that, but I don't actually think, in all honesty, that I'm like particularly influential on those topics. I do think that my work as a writer, as a political journalist, has some real impact on American politics and public policy in ways that matter, but often not in ways that are directly comparable to these kinds of things, because the margins that democratic politics happen on are just different from these ones. And I don't think, I mean, as just somebody who looks at the political system, like, I don't think trying to persuade accountable elected officials in a democracy to just like not care so much about the picayune problems of their citizens and to care way more about the problems of people suffering from parasitic worms in Central Africa. Like, I just don't think that would work. You know, it's contrary to the nature of the system, and it's why I think philanthropy is important. One thing I say in politics is that I do think philanthropy is important. There's a style of like left-wing politics that sort of derides the idea of people giving their money away versus the state directing everything. And something I try to tell people is like, democracy is good. That is definitely how political systems should be organized, but there are limits to what is going to be accomplished through that. And there's a really important role for civil society, for very wealthy individuals, but also for pretty normal people, just being more generous and helping others. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not the kind of guy who puts together a spreadsheet where I try to say what's the value of a life saved versus like maybe you marginally contributed to passing a better law about something. But I mostly see them as operating in fairly separate domains, which is fine. Then there's the third ground, which is that I do try to help propagate a worldview that moves people toward rationalism, that moves people toward cosmopolitanism, and hopefully both improves their politics, but also, you know, improves their conduct as potential donors.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, a ton to dig in there, but I'll resist the urge to do it to get to more questions. One on a somewhat similar theme, just in terms of like big picture drivers of human progress, is coming from Kat Friedman, who's asking, you know, there's been huge improvements in health globally since Gabal was founded. And what do you think have been the most important drivers of those improvements in human health over the last 12, 15 years? And he's quite curious about both Matt and Ellie's takes on that.
Well, I bet Ellie knows, so you should say.
I mean, I think I'm just going to point to the success of the, not literally the programs that GiveWell funds, but the types. I mean, I think one of the biggest recent successes in global health is the, reduction in child mortality. This reality that, through the early 1800s, the percentage of children who didn't reach their fifth birthday all over the world was sort of unfathomable to us today. And, you know, that number has gone from, more than 10 million to fewer than 5 million. I mean, still an unbelievably large number, 5 million children don't, reach their fifth birthday. But that progress, I think, is largely driven by huge successes in, what some people sometimes think of as, pretty boring delivery of health commodities. But I guess our perspective here at GiveWell is those boring health commodities do a lot of good. And, let's take care of that boring, helpful way to help people before trying to do too much. But you can see that success. And I think it's a huge win for the world that, so many more children just have that opportunity to live, live to adulthood.
Yeah, and I would say there's always, not just looking at the brief time period since GiveWell was founded, but, in broader sweep across the 20th and 21st centuries, that, we've seen technological improvements that help with human health, but also, sort of organizational improvements, right? Like how to actually put things together, how to actually deploy things that exist. And that's also where we see gaps, right? I mean, we know that vaccination has saved an incredible number of lives since it was first initiated as a process. We also know that lots of people do not receive vaccinations that they should have. This has become like an urgent problem in our first world politics, but it was a lingering problem all along. And every once in a while, we do get breakthroughs on these fronts, right? And we are able to move products to more people. And that's a really exciting sort of area for the future. There's the kind of middle ground between pure redistributive and pure like innovation focused. And it's like, how do we actually use the tools that are at our disposal? Because it's good. It's really good for people to take vaccines and they don't always. Anything you can do to find ways to make that happen really does a lot of good.
Yeah.
Thanks, Matt. So we've got 3 minutes left. I want to just quickly cover some housekeeping and then ask one last question of Matt. So Just thanks so much to everyone who's joined today. If you have any further questions or want to dig deeper, just please email us at info@givewell.org and you'll get a response. And thanks so much for people who've already donated or even thinking about doing so. And finally, we love getting feedback. So if there's any feedback on this event or ways we can be better, please do send those through. And just to close things out, you know, Matt, I started the intro just saying how, I think people just really look to you as the gold standard for diving into complex, important topics and being able to, express them in a way that is compelling and interesting to a broad range of people without losing nuance. And clearly that's part of the project of GiveWell and giving effectively and caring about causes that might seem far from you. And so, I'm curious in the closing minutes, whether you have any advice for GiveWell or for this broader movement on how we can be communicating, why we think these things are important and why people should care to a broader set of folks that we're not maybe currently touching.
GiveWell's presentation really is super appealing to me. I really, really love it. And the way you guys do things and, how there's a lot of writing and it's nested in a certain kind of way. And it mirrors some of how I write. Something that I always think about is, when you start operating on different margins, right, is are there whole other audiences who would appreciate totally different presentational styles. I'm really glad about the nice things you said about me. I am always glad to find a community of people who like the kind of writing that I do. Something that I've also found working over the years is that there's lots and lots of people who don't like that, and who appreciate totally different modes of storytelling, some of which I personally am no good at. But if I wanted to take myself bigger somehow, right? The goal would be finding, people who tell stories in other mediums or in other ways, right? And to say, look, there's different audiences that we're trying to reach and they might like different ways of looking at these things or looking at these findings. I don't think that GiveWell is maxed out in terms of, possible impact on the fussy nerds of the world, because there are a lot of us out there, and it has been a really steep growth curve, I think in terms of the amount of money that's moved so far. So I don't know that I would recommend that change exactly now, but in the spirit of things to explore, right, it's how do you connect to people who, have different big picture moral worldviews, but still actually might change their behavior if they knew some of the facts that are at your disposal. How do you connect to people who find these spreadsheets alarming, rather than reassuring, but still might care what you have to say, because people are weird. There's a diverse ecology of human beings out there. I struggle to understand them. And I think the kind of people who like spreadsheets sometimes struggle to understand them. But we've all got to work at it, right? And sort of be the best we can be.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks so much, Matt, for your time today and for your support of GiveWell and for joining us in this conversation.
Thank you.
And thanks most of all to all of our supporters. Thanks for joining today.
Yeah, thanks everybody.